I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Coppola Connections, where we plan to shake every branch of the Coppola family tree to find out, are they the greatest film family of all time? On last week's episode, we looked at Francis Ford Coppola's 1974 paranoid thriller, The Conversation. This week, however, we're looking at a little-known branch of the family tree, Christopher Coppola, or as some know him, Nicolas Cage's older brother, and his adaptation of the cult classic Mike Allred graphic novel, Graphic Music, in 2000's G-Men from Hell. To help me make some Coppola connections this week and look at this film is comedian and podcast host Nathaniel Metcalf. I could have happily chatted to Nathaniel all day. In fact, I actually chatted to him for an extra 40 minutes, which you can hear over on Patreon, where we discuss the man who started this podcast journey, Nicolas Cage. To support the podcast on Patreon, head on over to patreon.com/cagedinpod. As is always the case, we go into this film in forensic detail, so there will be spoilers aplenty. So if you haven't seen this film, please do be sure to check out a handy document that is in the show notes that will tell you if and where this film is streaming. In the UK at the moment, I know that this one is on YouTube. Make of that what you will, as nobody has taken it down. But for now, it's time to escape from hell, set up a PI business, and try to do some good in this goddamn world as we try and make some Coppola connections. On this episode, we're looking at Christopher Coppola's adaptation of Michael Allred's comic, Graphic Music, titled G-Men from Hell. Released in the year 2000, elsewhere in the Coppola family, Christopher's brother Nick starred in both Gone in 60 Seconds and The Family Man, whilst Nick's then-wife Patricia Arquette was helping the devil's son in Little Nicky. To help me figure out if this is cinematic heaven or hell, is comedian, podcaster, and co-chairman of FUBAR's premier film-based radio show that's not actually about films, Fan Club. Nathaniel Metcalf, how are you, sir?
I'm very well, yeah. I almost had to correct you. I think now we've probably been going long enough that we can probably just say it is about films. Yes. And now we have a guest on and talk to him about whatever. The first hour is almost certainly about films. It's not really supposed to be, but it'll end up being about films regardless of whatever else we were talking about.
I always love reading the blurb that FUBAR put out that kind of says like, oh yeah, it's like Room 101 but opposite. People bring in the things they love, and it's like, no, it's not. It's about John Carpenter, and sometimes like Nick will go on a big binge about talking about Adam Sandler films.
It's just that we've made no concession to what we would talk about if we weren't on the radio, I think. Which I think is good in a way, but at the same time, there's a bit of me going, I mean, this isn't, does this go out? It feels very, it's very, I don't know. It's good. I mean, I like it, but I would. It doesn't feel like a proper radio show a lot of the time. It is just us chatting, and there is fair, I mean, in a way, we do it to time, and we often try and get back onto the topics we were talking about to begin with, which we probably wouldn't bother with if we're just talking in a pub. But we don't even have pubs now. And the time we've done it since lockdown, Nick's currently possibly permanently, possibly not, but he's stopped drinking for now. So it means even if we do get back to pubs, we're all on soft drinks again now. So I guess...
Perfect.
But we've gone through changes. We're going through changes.
Well, before we get into talking about this film, and there's a lot to talk about, let's be honest. When did you first become aware of the Coppola family as an entity?
I was trying to think of this. I have no idea, because I think I sort of always knew. I'm 41, and it is currently early 2021. I was born in 79, and I was trying to think what would have been the first. Like, I knew, for example, who Francis Ford Coppola was for sure when The Godfather 3 came out. Mm-hmm. And I also knew, I think, that I would have known probably, like, I kind of probably got into films in a big way in my sort of mid-teens. Mm-hmm. But then I was already watching lots of stuff, and I think I already knew who they were and who he was, even though I probably wouldn't have seen a lot of his films at the time. And I kind of knew, and I knew things. Yeah, I knew, for example, like I knew that Nicolas Cage was his nephew. I knew that. And even though it took me a while to figure out why he was called Cage then. Why is he called Cage then? Why is he called Cage? That was probably the last bit of the penny to drop. It shouldn't have taken that long. So I knew things like that. I don't know what the specific... I remember... But it could have been late 80s, early 90s. I remember once Peggy Sue Got Married was on TV, and knowing then.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And there's lots of those films from around that time. It's just when what I would have seen first and things like what would have been the first. Like, certainly when Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula came out, I knew who Francis Ford Coppola was, and I knew he was a big deal. And I think maybe people that grew up in that era, how old are you?
I'm 29, so I'm a bit younger than yourself. But
okay.
I remember quite early. Like, I think I can't remember a time when like I didn't know about, especially like The Godfather. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, me
even as like a, because obviously when it came out, The Godfather was like the biggest film of all time, and it's like such an oddity to look at, because if you look at it now, it's like, imagine like an 18 being like the biggest film of all time. And it's like back in the days where they didn't really care about kids in the cinema. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of that happened in what, like 1977 with Star Wars. Like,
yeah.
Before then, it was just like men. Like, you can imagine a lot of smoky rooms going like, what do we want to make? Do you know what I mean? When you look at that kind of 70s new Hollywood generation of directors, they're all like, you know, your Robert Altmans and that and stuff. They're all, you can just imagine like a lot of smoking, a lot of cocaine, just going like, we're gonna make film for men, we like this adult stuff. And then it's George Lucas came along and went, well guys, actually I'm gonna make a space opera.
I think that's it. I think in that era, which I guess is probably growing up in a time when all that just sort of finished, and yet, like the kind of chemtrail of what they produced was massive. So like every kid, even kids who weren't as into films as I was, I reckon would know the name Francis Ford Coppola, and they would know Martin Scorsese. I knew who they were before I saw any of their films.
Yes. Yeah. So,
and probably like you would know them in the same way that you would know George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. And you knew them I probably knew who they were when I was three or four. You know, like you kind of think like, you they were so, and you kind of think of that now, like I've got my friends' kids who are about that age. You think they won't know who any film directors are.
Yeah.
But I would know at that age. I mean, I don't know if that's, I'm not necessarily saying that's a bad thing. I think it's almost weirder that I would know. But I think from like very early, I know And it's not just, it wasn't just Lucas and Spielberg. You did know all these other people by the time you were very young. You knew that, you knew what The Godfather was. I'd never seen it. I knew what it was. I knew, and like I say, I would know who Nicolas Cage was when I was 10 or 9 or 10 or something.
I always find it funny. You mentioned earlier about like how he had the Cage name and not the popular name. And I think like he cites in that great Terry Wogan interview, if you've ever seen it, when he kind of like flips onto the stage. He says like, oh, kids used to pick on me and like would quote The Godfather to him and quote Francis Ford Coppola films at him at school. So like, when he kind of wanted to break out, he's like, I'm a comic book fan. I like Luke Cage. I'm going to adopt that name. But then like many of the Coppola family films, he did also want to suck at the teat of the family, like at any given opportunity. Because if you look at, especially that early 80s run, it's like Rumblefish, as you mentioned, Peggy Sue Got Married, and that The Cotton Club are all directed by Francis Ford Coppola. So this weird, like, I don't know, almost crime family-esque thing about...
I always think it's funny. I think it's probably something I picked up from the Easy Riders, Raging Bulls book that's just stuck with me. But at the time, he wanted to break in and he felt that Hollywood was so kind of, you were sort of beset by all these kind of dynasties there. And it was impossible to break in because Hollywood was run by these dynasties. Then he gets in and does exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
That it's entirely like, he just does the same thing. He doesn't. And I think like, certainly at the start, you can see that when he was doing all those American Zoetrope things, there was an idea that he was trying to hold the door open, and within a year or so, finding out, oh, I can't do that because that affects what I'm allowed to do now.
Yeah, there's a fantastic documentary on YouTube you can watch for free, which is all about like the kind of birth and somewhat demise of American Zoetrope and obviously his grand plans of like being out of the Hollywood system and kind of setting up in San Francisco and having studios, but it just sounded like a mess. Like they used to have like parties, and I think they were like the first offices ever to have like a coffee machine. That's like a big part of the documentary. I talk about, you'd go there and get a cappuccino. Like everyone's going nuts for it. He had like this kind of, looks like something out of like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory.
Well, it's exactly the same principle, which again didn't work as the Beatles did with Apple. Exactly the same thing. And then when they try and do it, you just can't do it because it's such a nice idea. It's such a lovely idea. And it's what probably most people think of if they go, I'll tell you what I'd do if I had millions of dollars. And weirdly, I guess the first person through the door at American Zoetrope was Lucas, who then sort of did do that. Yeah. He immediately, once he had Star Wars, basically went, right, well, I'm making all this stuff myself then, and I'll sell it back to you if you want it. Which is what essentially what Francis Ford Coppola was trying to do and didn't really manage.
Yeah, I think it's mentioned in Easy Riders, Raging Bulls. So like, kind of Francis Ford Coppola's like biggest downfall is it's kind of like fly on the seat of his pants kind of guy of like, I will put all my chips on the table in whatever I'm doing. And like, I think he was just on the verge of bankruptcy at all times, especially that 70s run. Like, you look at Apocalypse Now, a film we're talking about like off air, and he's like kind of just like, right, this is supposed to be X amount of days shooting, I've been here for better part of a year, and it's like I don't know if it's going to work. Like, he put up the money to fund it and stuff like that, and there's really interesting things like the director's company as well, when they tried to make, I think they made two films. They were supposed to have William Friedkin make a film as well, but it was THX 1338 and The Conversation, and then like William Friedkin went, nah, don't think so. I
something else, didn't he, or something? Did he? Was that the Exorcist? Maybe that was The Exorcist.
I think he'd got the like Exorcist paycheck and went, I've made one of the biggest.
Yeah,
I've made one of the biggest films of all time right now, so I don't need your little company, Francis. Like, you're all right. Obviously, we've established how you became aware of the family. What about Christopher Coppola? Do you know much about Christopher Coppola as a director?
Still don't. Like, I still don't. And even when I'm sort of looking up at his IMDb, you go, this is the only, The G-Men from Hill is the only film of his I've seen. I know he's Katie's brother, so he, I guess, is another nephew of Francis.
Yeah.
And you kind of, again, I feel like there was lots of, I feel like he was mentioned when people would do a list of all the people who were related to Francis Ford Coppola. But apart from the, you know, the usual suspects, there seems to be a bunch of them who you go, I don't know who that is. So, there's also the guy, Sofia Coppola's brother, who is, you will know,
Roman Coppola.
Roman Coppola.
Yeah, who writes
a film called CQ that I like a lot.
Yeah, so it's obviously going to be covered at some point on this podcast. But, and obviously he's got like his fingers in a lot of pies with, you look at like the Wes Anderson films and then you start looking at the technicals and it's like, oh, he's second unit director on Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, or he's written Moonrise Kingdom. And then you look at the Schwartzman side of the family through Talia Shire, and then it's like, fucking hell, you've got like, Jason Schwartzman's probably got more screen time than Nicolas Cage, a prolific actor. You start factoring in like TV shows. He's done like multiple seasons of like HBO shows where it's bored to death. And it's like, I'm going to be doing this forever. But it's like, what a family. And like, back to that kind of mafioso like way that they are, is there's like, Jason Schwartzman's dad used to be an agent before he married Talia Shire, then became a film producer. So it's like, even when somebody's introduced to the family, it's like, no, you have to actually have a finger in making films now, whether it's behind or in front of the camera. It's this weird, like, when they're
exactly, it's that thing of The Godfather ends up being, and again, this sort of film that he wasn't that keen on doing becomes this, that they become this family and this dynasty that are always going to be making stuff. Have you ever seen New York Stories?
No, again, that's one that, that's the kind of Woody Allen, Francis Ford Coppola and Martin Scorsese, right? It's kind of like...
Yeah, the Francis Ford Coppola bit of that is another really odd one, because it basically is like prototype Wes Anderson. It's like it's such that it's almost that you go, wow, I mean, it's like he invented Wes Anderson and then let Wes Anderson carry on making films like that. But I guess it's also similar in tone to something like Sofia Coppola would do. It would be more like one of her films. It feels such an odd little throwaway little 25 minute sequence, which is probably then it is. It just feels like it's so much like what would then be a sort of almost commonplace sort of 90s indie film aesthetic 10 years later.
Well, even when you look at being John Malkovich, that was offered to Francis Ford Coppola, who at the time Spike Jonze was married to Sofia Coppola, and said like, no, I know the guy would be perfect to direct this. And it's like, they like basically gave him like, I don't know, like that mafia boss, like kiss on the hand or something, to be like, it's your turn, Spike. Like, here's a job for you. Go out and direct this one. And then it's like, his career kind of blossomed after that. It's a very like, I don't know, it's great. But at the same time, it's this weird, like, nepotistic, odd.
It's a great spider's web of kind of coming up. And I mean, someone like Christopher Coppola, I guess, really, I mean, he seems to have made a living in an industry which is difficult, but he's done it by directing episodes of TV shows and not necessarily been this sort of, certainly never A-list, never really close to it, and always kind of on the fringes of the sort of mainstream bits of that.
I know people who've like interviewed Christopher Coppola, and there's one film he refuses to talk about, which is, to a lot of people, it's like kind of like a cult classic, Deadfall, his 1993 film starring Nick Cage and Charlie Sheen's in it. And I'm trying to think, Michael Biehn is like the actual star of it, but it's this kind of madcap Nicolas Cage performance where you might have seen like stills of it. He's got this mustache and like a really bad hairdo, and he's just kind of like screaming and shouting. And it was kind of one of those, like, you know, when you see those clip reels of Nicolas Cage going wild. Yeah, that's the one film like Christopher Coppola never talks about. And it's this, and that again is littered with, like, I think it's Nick Cage is in it, Talia Shire's in it, their other brother Mark Coppola's in that film. And it's like a very bizarre one. But he's a fascinating looking guy, right? Have you ever seen a photo of
him? Yeah, I've seen photos of him. Yeah.
he almost looks like, he looks like this kind of like pirate, like biker almost. And it's, I don't know. He's a fascinating guy from everything I've kind of like, I've obviously in preparation, I've listened to like podcasts he's been on and stuff like that. And they're like, he's talking about, like, he talks about cinema in a very like, oh yeah, it's like being experimental. And he teaches film as well. I'm not like, we'll get into like why I think maybe that's not the best idea, because this film, like, on a technical level, has got some ropey things going on in it.
Two hardened government agents, wrongly set up, are murdered and sent to hell.
This is the place the nuns were talking about.
Tate Donovan, Bobcat Goldthwait, Paul Rodriguez, Gary Busey, and Robert Goulet as the devil.
Look, that was not like you think. Okay.
G-Men from Hell.
First thing we do, set up a PI business.
I'd like to hire you.
Have you seen these two men? We ain't going back.
You're still alive.
Who is?
Our G-Man.
I will personally drag your bones back to hell.
Starting to like this good deed business.
You were both puppets for Buffard, weren't you?
Who are you calling a puppet?
Back off, Pinocchio.
Starring William Forsythe, Tate Donovan, Bobcat Goldthwait, Paul Rodriguez, Gary Busey, and Robert Goulet as the devil.
Look, that was not like you think. Okay.
G-Men from Hell.
Bodies falling from heaven.
Actually, we're from hell.
What is your relationship with this film, Nathaniel?
Well, I probably followed the production of this film very closely. And I wanted to do this one when you asked me to be on the podcast, because I thought, either no one else would do it, or you'd eventually get to it, and it would be people going, I don't know what this is. And so I thought, well, I'll do this, because it feels like I kind of know exactly what it is. It's I'm a big, massive fan of a cartoonist called Mike Allred, who is the person who created the G-Men from Hell in comics. And I'm a huge fan of his, and I've got multiple different versions of comics he's done. I think at one point I had everything he did, but now, sort of good and bad thing, he became much more prolific and started doing lots of covers for things, and it was almost impossible to kind of keep up with how much he was actually doing. And at which point, I don't think I do, but I think I still got most of it, and I certainly get anything new that he's contributed more than just a cover to. And the G-Men from Hell is from a series he did called Graphic Music, as you say. But that was, the G-Men from Hell section was half of it.
Okay.
And it was in a story that was called Goulash. It wasn't named G-Men from Hell. And G-Men from Hell is basically this thing that was in this thing called Goulash. And the idea, it's called Goulash, which is a better title for it, because it was this idea that he was just starting out in comics and he had so many ideas. And he said, why are genre so stiff? So he tries to create something which is like, he basically goes through essentially cinematic and comic book genres and very kind of wild ones and go, what if they all exist in exactly the same story? Mm-hmm. So it's basically creates a murder mystery story which features 1940s FBI agents, the devil, horror elements, superheroes, robots, mad scientists, and basically goes, right, so we're going to have 40s kind of G-Men movies, 50s sci-fi, 1960s almost Adam West Batman superheroes, and what if they're all in the same comic? And this idea is kind of what he's done throughout his career in comics. And they're brilliant, and they kind of work so well on the page for me. And I'm a real sucker for all this stuff. And he kind of, this was his sort of first go at it, and he sort of refined it as he went on. But they're always this sort of weird mix of genre, and they kind of become, as they go on, they become even more kind of existential, and they're sort of, but they're all sort of filtered through this huge kind of pop culture kind of funnel. And what comes out is often this kind of mad, often quite, they look quite, often quite childlike ideas, but are actually very dark mm-hmm. as well. And they've got this, and I'm a huge fan of them. And my thing with G-Men from Hell is that it never finished as well. So you only got about three parts of Goulash. It never ended. and then later on, he started writing, his next thing was a character called Madman, who was a sort of superhero archetype that he realized, oh, well, this is what sells in comics. So I'll take a character who is in Goulash, put a costume on him, and this will be my character, Frank Einstein. And then Frank Einstein became this big, big sort of breakout hit in the early 90s. And that has been in sort of development hell with Robert Rodriguez for about 20 years. And it's never been made into a movie. This was like this big sort of hit character. And then I think later on, I think Christopher Coppola was one of the people who tried to initially get the license to do a Madman film, but couldn't because it was already bought up. It was either, I think Universal had it for a while, and then I think Robert Rodriguez took it over. So I think around that time, around the sort of late 90s, Christopher Coppola was trying to make a Madman film, I believe, couldn't get the rights, but then he realized that if the Frank Einstein character, who's the main character in Madman, he also featured before he had a costume in his series Goulash. And so what they do is they basically extricate the Frank Einstein character, and what they're left with is these kind of G-Men character, and that's basically the basis for the G-Men from Hell movie. So it takes all these sort of supporting characters, who a lot of them end up in the Madman series, and have them instead. So it's a bit like, I guess, what, you know, like the Fox with X-Men, and what exactly who they have rights to and who they don't.
Yes.
How they kind of cross over with the ones that Marvel had the rights to and how they didn't. So you've got lots of characters like Dr. Boffard is a big character in Madman. The G-Men show up later in Madman. And later on, essentially, because when the film came out, I think he probably saw it at the time that this might be a big movie. It wasn't. But like, I think he thought there was a possibility that, oh, what I should do then. So the idea was that in the year 2000, he was currently working on this huge series that was called The Atomics. But he was also aware that, oh, there's a countdown to when this movie's going to come out. So this is almost the time he became super prolific and basically changed the way he drew. So he was able to draw a lot faster. It's still very, like, he sort of changed his style, but it sort of became like, there was a lot of energy to what he was doing, and it was still really good. So he sort of became super prolific, changed the way he was drawing so he could draw a lot faster. And also hated, never reprinted any of that graphic music stuff. I do have it somewhere. Can't find it. I've got that too, I want to show you. And he basically redrew all the Goulash stuff and made it into a flashback in the Madman series, and then was able to finish the Goulash series like a decade after it started. So all the stuff that's in the at the beginning, the opening credits of the movie, which are great. The opening credits start off as you just get pages of this comic, yeah, which is essentially what was from the later Madman series, just completely taken out. But it's, what ruins it is it's also it's intercut with this terrible sort of speech bubbles mm-hmm. of the cast and the name of the film. And a thing that really feels like, I mean, you could have done better. In 2001, 2000, you could have done better than that. And just to say, yeah, it's like comic books, like comic books.
If we look at like comic book films that came out in the year 2000, mm-hmm. this is the same year as X-Men. like Bryan Singer's first X-Men. And it's like, if you hold these two films up to each other, it's like, wow, like this is very like, and it, again, it kind of, you said it plays with like noir tropes and stuff like that. And like the score is very much like screaming like noir, but it's more soapy than it is pulpy. And it's like your kind of description of the backstory of the comic and stuff like that. It feels like you need to know all of that before watching this film, because you kind of
do. I think that's it. I think it's, and actually my issue with it is I'm watching it going, how would you even relate to this if you don't know its origin? Except I kind of think, I think it's a far from perfect film.
Oh.
There's so much about it I think is done really well. It's sort of like, it's so successful in translating this comic, which is a bit rough around the edges to begin with, but it does such a good job in translating it. But what it does, it brings it out in this, it kind of exists in a vacuum. It doesn't exist without everything around it. It's this, but in a way, like you say, it's sort of, oh, it came out the same year as X-Men. It's not trying to be X-Men.
No.
And it's got, what I think is good about it is it absolutely knows what it is. I just don't think it lets the audience know.
Yeah. Because I was there like going, is it meant to be a period piece? Like, obviously, like it's very like 1940s, like noir. But then it's like, there's references to CDs. There's like this kind of like, it's a real hodgepodge. And it felt like as a script, like lots of different scripts, like the pages just got muddled. They went, here you go. Like,
not a spoof. It's pastiche, but it's not pastiching one thing.
Yeah.
It's pastiching eight different things at once, which is exactly what the comic is. And I think it's a really good example of something that works incredibly well on the page. But in that same way that often when comic book movies were coming out from Superman on, Superman does such a good job of creating this mythology because it didn't really exist before that. So much of what they sort of put onto that Superman mythology with the Christopher Reeve movies were things that are only vaguely in the comics anyway and kind of didn't really make sense. And they kind of create this sort of definitive origin story. That then the comics go, oh yeah, that's much better. You know, that's like, so we'll kind of hold on to that. Whereas in the sort of, it took another 20 years for them to kind of start getting things right. To the point where, you know, the Marvel movies now are sort of made by Marvel.
Yeah.
So they go, well, why don't we just do them exactly like they are in the comics rather than trying to adapt them into a way that people go, well, that won't work on film. And they, what Marvel do, I think, very well is that they take, they're kind of very well adapted from their source material. They're not really trying to change anything.
Yeah.
They're just trying to, if something feels like it might not work on screen, they try and explain why it's going to work on screen, or they don't, it's not so much changing anything. They just kind of change something about it. Like the problem, I remember when they were making a Black Panther film, and Black Panther was one of those characters I really liked as a comic. But at the same time, I was going, but it's a very white version of what Africa's like. It's a very dated, I don't think you can do a film of this, because I think if you make a Black Panther film, it's almost inherently racist now. not because it was ever trying to be or anything. It's just by its nature, it's almost impossible. It's this sort of magical African.
Yeah.
It sort of becomes this sort of a bit kind of dodgy and a bit kind of, oh, that's tricky. Even though the intentions of making it at the time were in the 60s and 70s, it was to be very like right on.
Yeah.
Except for 30 years later, what was seen as very right on and progressive now feels like absolutely not. And yet what they do is they don't really change anything about it, but they just do it. But they do it from like a black perspective.
Yeah.
And you go, that's how you do it. And you go, and you watch it and you go, that's exactly how you do it. And you haven't even changed it. And yet, like on paper, like I was thinking, I think me now, as someone who's never made a film, would love to make a film. I think if in whatever year it was, 2015, 2016, if Marvel Studios came to me, who'd never made a film, and said, listen, we want you to make a new Marvel movie. And you go, that's amazing. Which one? And they said to me, Black Panther. I'd say, absolutely not. I'm going absolutely nowhere near that. Because I wouldn't know how to do it. In a way, you go, well, I'd love to do it, but I can't. I couldn't possibly. And what they actually did, I think that in some ways, for me, I think that is one of the best Marvel movies, simply because it's like, when I watched it, I went, wow, yeah, that's how you do it. That's exactly how you do it now. It was sort of, it comes from such a, I mean, it's not dodgy source material, because it is definitely trying. It's really progressive in its era, but it just isn't. It's not 21st century at all. And to do it, to put it on screen, was really impressive.
So when would have G-Men from Hell come out in relation to graphic music? Would it have been like...
The movie?
Yeah.
Graphic music came out, I think, in 91,
okay,
think.
Okay, so
1990, 1991, something like that.
So we've got 9 years. So let's talk about the film. So the cast list, like, it's a pretty decent cast, right?
It's like... Oh, it's a brilliant cast. It's so, always what I think you should do in those kind of indie movies.
Yeah.
Is so, that instead of getting, like, you get a bunch of people who are kind of character actors, and you make all of the character actors the stars.
Mm-hmm.
It's so great.
So let's look at who we've got. We've got William Forsythe as Dean Krept. We've got Tate Donovan as Mike Mattress.
Mm-hmm.
Bobcat Goldthwait as Buster Lloyd, Barry Newman as Grayland Lake, Zach Galligan as Dalton, Gary Busey as Lieutenant Langdon, who possibly has like one of the best introductions into a film.
Yes.
Like his kind of like open, like turns up on the scene and says to like Zach Galligan's character, who's his new partner. And Zach Galligan's like, it's kind of like sniveling.
He's the commissioner's son as well, isn't he?
Yeah.
Zach Galligan's the commissioner's son. And he's kind of, you feel like he's been promoted above, mm-hmm. above other people in the force.
And it's just kind of like, I again, like, does it go into that character of Lieutenant Langdon more in the comic book from what you remember? Because we kind of like, we get this weird introduction with like an apology or almost like an acceptance from Zach Galligan's character going like, I know you're gay, like, it's fine, it's fine.
Yeah, I don't mind.
Yeah, and Gary Busey's opening line is, I'm a sadistic leather master homosexual and I will tease your sensibilities, which almost sounds like something that would have been, like, very easily put into the script of, like, a Clive Barker novel or, like, do you know what I mean? It could have easily been torn out of the pages of Hellraiser or something. And it's
those characters don't appear in the comics. They're ones that are almost exclusively in the films. most are from the comics. Those characters, and weirdly, actually, now I think about it, the reason they don't appear in the comics, the film, I should say, is a really good adaptation. And it's slightly, I'm sure there must be some sort of SAG rules that mean that Michael Rood can't be listed as screenwriter, mm-hmm. but the dialogue is pretty much from the comics as well. There's nothing in it. But there are scenes like that those characters are introduced in it and aren't in the comics, but there's no need for them really to be in the film.
No.
If you cut them out. I think for running time, they kind of introduce these sort of subplots with like those two characters that kind of show up at intervals, but they're not really, you know, they're basically investigating the G-Men who are themselves investigating a murder mystery.
Yeah. So
they're almost like following them around, but there's no real need for them to be in it.
Before we get too deep into talking about it, could you give us a setup of this film? What is the kind of like the basic plot?
The basic plot is that Dean Krept and Mike Mattress are two kind of, I mean, they're 40s era FBI agents, mm-hmm. in look and in in presentation and
attitude
in a film way. Yeah. They're sort of in the movie world, they're movie FBI agents from the 40s, except they basically exist in the present day. And they and Dean Kreps' wife and daughter have been murdered in their cars, essentially exploded by something mysterious, and you never really find out who's behind it for sure, which I guess was going to be the ongoing storyline about it. And then they themselves are killed. It's assumed that Dean Kreps' wife and daughter are good people and went straight to heaven, whereas Tate Donovan's character, Mike Mattress, and William Forsythe, Dean Kreps, they get sent to hell because they've been doing bad things. And actually, in the comics, they're probably a bit worse. They're not as likable. And it's probably quite clear that, yeah, you've gone to hell because you're kind of corrupt FBI agents. But still, because they're essentially FBI agents, they see themselves very much as being good guys, even though they might have done terrible things to criminals and are completely, completely bent. Because they're on the side of good, they see themselves as good guys, which I guess in the comics, I guess that's clearer in the idea that is that, you know, these people are kind of corrupt, but they themselves wouldn't even think of themselves as corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
They get sent to hell at the beginning of the film. In fact, not even at the beginning of the film. That's done in comic book.
Yeah.
You don't actually see any of that. And then the film begins with them in hell, and the devil, played by Robert Goulet, is who's, you know, a lounge singer, and he's playing Robert Goulet playing the devil. Is a sort of lounge singer who I think at the start is getting kind of psychoanalyzed by Sigmund Freud, also in hell. and meanwhile, Kreps and Mattress are trying to figure a way, and they find that there's a crystal that will basically take them back to Earth. So they send themselves back to Earth and decide that once they're there, if they commit enough good deeds, they will eventually be allowed into heaven. So they basically set up a private investigations. They become PIs, and the idea is they're going to help people rather than do bad things, even though probably less so. In the comics, both of them are kind of bad people. In the film, Tate Donovan's much more willing to still do bad things, and Dean Kreps is sort of trying to make him go, is sort of the more moral one of the two, and he's trying to get them back on track. So if they do good deeds, they essentially earn their way into heaven.
Which is a weird like thing in casting, because like Tate Donovan has got like a very like could do no wrong face. Do you know what I mean? He looks like such like a nice guy, and like he's like, I think only like a few years earlier he had voiced Hercules in the Disney animation, which links this film to that, in that Bobcat Goldthwait is also a voice in that film.
So
I think he plays like Pain or Suffering, like the kind of Hades, like minions. And obviously, if you hear Bobcat Goldthwait's voice, you know it's Bobcat Goldthwait. Like, he's like that, even if he's trying to play like a mobster in this, he's still got the like going on, it's breaking all over the place. But then in the film is when we get all of these subplots kind of thrown in, and it's like it gets crazy, right? Because my notes here, I just kept putting down, who's this? Like who's this bloke in a cheetah onesie? Then all of a sudden, like, who's this bloke with a puppet? Like, what? And it does nothing to introduce these characters to you. It's just all of a sudden, like the camera cuts from a Dutch angle to some very dark room. I'm not sure if that is because I watched this film on YouTube, and I've got to admit, I'm very wary if a film is on YouTube and is not taken down very quickly. I'm like, what is the quality of that film?
Well, the movie was made in 99 and didn't get a DVD release until 2002.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of in limbo. So I was waiting for it. Like, that's it. It feels like I was probably one of the few people in the world who was anxiously waiting for this film to drop, as you'd say now. And yet it came out 2002 on DVD. But I think the DVD was largely sold to fans of Mike Allred.
Yes.
And it feels like the commentary is by him. There's no Christopher Coppola or anything on the commentary on the DVD. And it's, and I think it's sold more as a curiosity, like, we're basically going to release the, we can sell it to however many thousand people are fans of Mike Allred comics, I think.
Well, the film's like rebranded once it gets like a home release, in that it's retitled Mike Allred's G-Men from Hell, as opposed to, like, I think the original, it's just G-Men from Hell, like, a film by Christopher Coppola. Like, it's, as you say, it's, and like you showed me the DVD, it's like it hasn't got the god awful poster like artwork that kind
which,
of like,
which with someone on it who I suspect isn't William Forsythe, is a G-man who's pulled his hat down just enough that he's completely anonymous.
Yeah, and it looks more like I don't know, it looks more like Nick Nolte. Or something, yeah, like, it's very
it's
weird.
It's definitely not going to be any of the people in it. They've just hired someone to put a hat on and pull it down over their face and put flames behind it that signify hell. And again, that doesn't look like what the film looks like. No. I mean, in a way, the cover to the DVD that I've got, which is just a Mike Allred illustration, is kind of how they should have done all of the publicity.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think if you'd seen that, you'd go, oh, it's going to be comic booky. It's going to be Adam West Batman. That's just a much better, and that's what they're trying to do as well. It's not that they're going away from it.
The artwork it's got gives it more of that like look that you're going to see it in the, like, it looks like it came out very early 90s at least, and it would be a video that like is collecting a lot of dust in the video shop, because it makes it look terrible. Like, not that you should judge a book or a film by its cover, but it's like, if I'm going off of like the poster art for G-Men from Hell, it's like, nah, I think I'll give it a steer. If I, like, as I, well, I would have been 11 years old when this film kind of came out, if I was like in the, yeah, if I was in Blockbuster and I was like, you got X-Men there, or you got G-Men from Hell, I'd go, I think I'm going to go for X-Men. Yeah. Like,
in a way, again, Goulash is a much better title.
Yeah.
Because it's basically saying it's got everything in it.
Yeah, it's a hodgepodge of, like, and that's the thing. Anything goes. Just having this conversation, I kind of like, I'm softening to the film ever so slightly. But that's only because I've got this context now. If you had asked me right at the beginning of this conversation, what do you think of this film? I'd be like, it's crap. Like, do you know what I mean? And now I kind of understand what it's trying to do, and it doesn't quite execute some things. Like, Christopher Coppola has got this overuse of Dutch angles in this film, which is just like, come on. Like, just straighten up the camera. Do you know what I mean?
Like, I know. Again, even some of that stuff I forgive, because it feels like it's going for something which isn't comic booky, sort of. Like, I know, like, I totally see what it's going, or it's what it's trying to do, and it's my problem. Well, it's not a problem with it. I sort of don't have a problem with it. I think it's incredibly successful in what it's doing. I think for comic book movies, it's like, it sort of does it right. I think the problem with it, which is the problem films like Watchmen and certainly Sin City, is that you can do it and you can go, finally, they've made a film which is entirely authentic to its source material.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work as a film.
Yeah.
It's entirely authentic to what it's, to its source material, but it's not really a great movie, mm-hmm. because it's so tied to being, so the correct way to do it is almost not to try and adapt it completely accurately. It's probably a bit better to try and do something slightly different, or to try and do what is the movie version of that, which is what Marvel do now. They go, what is the movie version of Thor, or what is the movie version of Spider-Man? They and you know, something like Sin City, which like this has the same dialogue. The composition of all the shots are basically taken from panels of comics and reproduced and CGI'd so they essentially match.
Yeah.
And, you know, the comics are black and white or black, white and red because of printing. But they go, well, let's make it like that because it's we can do that now. Mm-hmm. We can make this black, white and red film. And then you get this sort of you watch them and they're fun to watch. But they're not real. And I'd like to see something like Sin City. I'd be interested to watch again. I haven't seen it for years and years. But afterwards, there's something quite hollow about that as well. It's that kind of it isn't quite what it's what the comic is. And it isn't a movie either. You kind of get this weird halfway house. And yet, as someone who is a big fan of the Mike Allred comics, there's something where you go, I mean, this is sort of wild. It's kind of exactly right. And yet it's not as well. It's also not quite right. But it's almost exactly right. But it's a, the reading experience of reading virtually the same material as you're watching on screen and knowing that that is entirely, you know, faithful to what you're reading. What you're reading is better.
Yeah. It's weird as a film as well, because it does feel like it is weirdly episodic, because you kind of like it feels like you've got this moment and it probably comes like nearly an hour in where you get them visited by the devil, who then like and for it to kind of set up like the machinations of the plot, basically, to be like you've got, what is it, 46 hours to solve this crime. It's like it's an hour and 38 minute long film. It's like that's pretty long to be setting that in motion. It's kind of the first close to an hour, it's kind of just been a bit meandering about. It's kind of got this weird CGI traveling from hell and down a sink and stuff like that. And then we just kind of get them wandering about, and we get Cheetah Man out, and we get introduced to all these subplots that we don't like.
They're also not resolved because because they never got resolved in the comics either. Because it stopped. The comic stopped because not enough people bought it. And he sort of then has another go and going, well, what if I have these characters in a slightly different context? And that becomes a hit. But so many of there's so many of these plot threads that were never resolved in the comics. And in a movie, especially one which is introducing new characters to cover running time, the writers don't really feel they've got the artistic license to try and finish off their stories. Mm-hmm. Like you get introduced to things like Cheetah Man's girlfriend. But why?
It's like why?
He doesn't really get a resolution. None of these characters get resolution, but they don't in the comics either, because it's a comic that ran for three issues and then stopped.
Well, it's got that, the thing with like Cheetah Man as well, you get this like glimpse at like, at something bigger, and like, oh, is this film trying to tell us something about like the like trying to be a hero? Is it worth it? Where she's like, oh, you need to go see your psychiatrist or like see a therapist. And it's like, oh, that's a really interesting thread. And it's like, oh, let's drop that. And then also, like,
it's something which is it's playing with comic book tropes that haven't yet been seen as films.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like in that you've got, he's this sort of angst-ridden 90s era superhero, but the joke is kind of, but he's a guy who dresses as a cheater.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of a joke on sort of superhero tropes. And so you've got almost like this angsty 80s, 90s era comic book where everything is kind of angsty, but drawn in a way that is like, but what if Adam West was like that?
Yeah.
And it's sort of a comic booky trope, which is in the comic is sort of being playful and is really like, it's sort of funny and it's something you sort of haven't seen and it's a bit of a joke on comics itself and the nature of these characters. What would they really be like? What would they really be like? And they still look like Adam West. What would that, what if they were really these, what if the comics today, which are very angsty, but what if they, instead of look like they were drawn in these 90s kind of very dark superhero characters, what if they still look like they did in the 60s? And you've got that, and that's, And it is often that thing where it's just translating these ideas that don't necessarily work on film. They work as... There was a really... what film was it for? I think it was when Mystery Men came out, which I guess this is a problem. That's probably a similar comparison to what they're trying to do in something like this. That there was a really great review I remember reading in Sight and Sound that Kim Newman wrote about it. And he said the reason this film... He said the film is really successful. He said the film's really good, but it's not going to land with audiences because movie audiences don't have a context for what it's spoofing. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, and at that time, he's saying, there's never been a Justice League movie.
Yeah.
There's never been a... So it's like, and now you would understand that, oh, they're like the Avengers or something. But all you'd had at that time was this, you'd have, there weren't that many superhero movies when Mystery Men came out.
Yeah.
So he was saying it's not going to work for modern audiences, and didn't, because they didn't know what it was spoofing. You didn't have a context for it. And the comics have their own context, and they're read by people that read comics. And when you adapt that stuff, it doesn't necessarily work as a film because there's no context to what you're looking at.
Yeah, definitely. And like, well, one of the questions I had for you was, in the comic book, does Gary Busey's character just disappear? But we've established it. He's not in the comic book, which makes me think with this film, like, I tried to dig for it. I was like, did he quit? Because like, it, all of a sudden, like, it's probably like in the last quarter of the film, like when they get to like the, what can only be like, it's like the kind of Agatha Christie or like, do you know what I mean? Like, yeah, murder mystery ending where they've throughout the film, they've said to everyone, like, tomorrow night at midnight, meet us at the church on L Street. And like, they've said it to everyone. It's like, all right, yeah, we're gonna assemble all the potential perps and pick out who it's going to be. And then we kind of just get that throwaway line from Zach Galligan, who's like, he did a deal with you guys. He's been suspended. And I was like, oh, I think there's more to that. I think,
yeah, there could be more to that, especially because they do bring them back for no reason. I think it might be running time, but they finished the script, looked at it, and it's 60 pages. And they add on these, because essentially their job is to investigate the G-men, who are themselves investigating the murder. And it's not like, it's not a very neat Elmore Leonardy thing where you end up with Mexican standoff of various different people wanting various different things off all the main characters. They basically turn up and kind of go, all right, have you done it? Cool. It's that kind of, it's not like it's, but I think the addition of Gary Busey fits into it. He fits into the world of it. They do a good job of introducing those characters as like, I can see these guys being in this film. And
It's just the fact that Gary Busey is all of a sudden gone, like, just stood out to me. It's like, there must be something that he, like, because he's quite a fiery guy from everything. Like, sure. I kind of imagine that maybe he went, fuck this shit. Like, I'm not just sitting in a church and being lectured to by William Forsythe and Tate Donovan whilst they kind of like go through. And it's like similar to like the end of Clue, where they kind of like go through all the potential motives of who it could be. And then when we find out who it is who committed the murder of, is it Grey Lake, the old gentleman? So yeah, the kind of the people we have who are the potential suspects, we have his wife, Gloria, who had hired the G-men.
It's Vanessa Angel.
Yes.
Very 90s era. Mm-hmm. But it is, it's this cast of people who are kind of, they're almost cast for being sort of Uber versions, turned up versions of who they are in other films, I guess. It's that
Well, yeah, you look at the casting of Frank McRae, who like kind of like shows up in like spoof films, in like Loaded Weapon 1, and he's also in Last Action Hero, and always normally plays that like angry chief inspector of the police. But in this, he's this kind of like overzealous landlord who's like being like, who has a great introduction. He's just, well, throughout the film, he's getting his shoes shined, and he kind of says like, you pay me on the first, and he's like, if you don't, like, I'll be there to see you. And it's like, And if I have to come again, I'm gonna graduate. I'm gonna graduate to itty bitty mincemeat. So you got these wacky performances all over the place. As we've established, like, you've got Bobcat Goldthwait, who's kind of quite subdued for Bobcat Goldthwait, right?
Yeah.
Who starts off as this low rent, like, kind of mobster, and then becomes this, as you alluded to.
Well, I think the robot. He was the one who blew up his wife and daughter's car in the pre-credit sequence. We don't know who's made him do it or who's put him onto it, but he's essentially the guy who executed it, whether he was behind it or not. David Huddleston, who is Santa Claus, mm-hmm. From Santa Claus the Movie, and is in various Coen Brothers movies as this sort of, and it's just sort of full of character actors who you all know from other things, and you go, even if you don't know them by name, it's like, oh, it's that guy.
Yeah.
Everyone is played by that guy or her. Carrie Wura at the time, who's their secretary. I can't remember her name. Have I got it up here?
She's called Marette Morris.
Yeah. She was at the time kind of on the way up, but never really got there. She was in things like Eight Legged Freaks around the same time.
Mm-hmm. And Paul, we should talk about Paul Rodriguez, who plays Winifred, the weenie man, who has got a very bizarre career. Just I remember looking, like, he's got like a two punch like credits on his IMDb, which goes, in 2009 he did a film called Porn Dogs: The Adventures of Sadie. And then a year later, he did Cats and Dogs, The Revenge of Kitty Galore. And it's like, he's really spreading out for all the kind of, the whole dog market. It's like, we'll play one for the adults and I'll do one for the kids. But yeah, he seems to be a voice actor through and through. But in this, he looks like some kind of, I don't know, demented, like, children's TV presenter or, like, character. And it's this big bouffant hair, and he's sent by the devil to get them back, right?
Yeah, and he looks like he's from again, at the time, their comics are different now, but like at the time, I think Mike Ord was a big, obviously the whole graphic music thing is very influenced by 8-Ball, mm-hmm. which was Dan Clowes's comic, which Ghost World comes out of, and Art School Confidential comes out of, and a lot of the stuff that were less kind of narrative things in 8-Ball were things that feature characters a lot more like Winifred. And it's very, that kind of 8-Ball, Dan Clowes world fits in a lot with the G-Men from Hell stuff as well. And I think Mike Ord at the time, I think, would have been really influenced by his comics. So there's a lot of that in it. Charles Fleischer is Martin and Pete, who is the man who has the his little hand glove puppet. And Charles Fleischer is the voice of Roger Rabbit. And mainly he is like a voice actor. But at the time of Roger Rabbit, Charles Fleischer, certainly over here, and I suspect was true in America, was the guy who was brought on to promote Roger Rabbit when it came out. So Charles Fleischer was brought out. He would have been on things like Blue Peter and Saturday Superstore. And so, like, he kind of became, like, for me, I knew who Charles Fleischer was because he was the Roger Rabbit guy. Mm-hmm. Because he would go on Blue Peter, do Roger Rabbit's voice. And so he's sort of perfect as this guy who has, you know, this hand puppet who acts like, you know, a sort of, and it's the trope of having the sort of haunted ventriloquist dummy.
Yeah.
But it's with a hand puppet and gets to do two voices. So that is a really fun character in the movie. And to get Charles Fleischer to do it, who's a voice actor who gets to play essentially two characters in one, is a really kind of neat bit of casting. And all the casting in it is sort of perfect.
Yeah.
I go, they're really well cast. And they're such a, and I always can never work out why lower budget movies don't try and populate your film with other character actors. So if you can't have big stars, why not have a whole cast full of, oh, it's that guy. It's
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Him. it's her off of that. It's the whole cast virtually to get pretty much to the last, the lowest rung member of the cast. In fact, one of the people who comes out at the end of the movie is you get a drunk who is handed the keys to the Rolls Royce at the end. And the drunk, that is Mike Allred.
Oh, amazing. Yeah. 'Cause I'm pretty sure early on in the film, it's probably uncredited cameo. Like, you see in the background on the street, you see Christopher Coppola as well. He's got a very striking, like, silhouette. So yeah, that ending, it gets revealed that it was Pete. So Dr. Bruford has this plan to take people's essence and put them into inanimate object, or like
he's a mad scientist who's basically essentially he's like a modern day B movie Victor Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. So he basically can reanimate corpses essentially, but he doesn't have to do it in the body of human beings. So he's like, well, how else can we do it? So he reanimates a robot who is Bobcat Goldthwait's character. Mm-hmm. It is, isn't it? Or is it? He's reanimated. He is then put into the body of a robot. And the robot, again, isn't like an android. It's a B-movie sci-fi robot.
Yeah, it's a man in a suit. And then there's that brilliant moment as well where he's doing repairs and trying to get a new head. And, like, it's just an amazing bit of, like, practical design. Of, like, there's just this microphone with a couple of eyes. Like when he's kind of, when he's fixing after Cheetah Man throws a TV on his head. And it almost looks like something out of Beetlejuice or something, like the shrunken heads. And like all of a sudden, Bobcat Goldthwait's voice is like pitched up and stuff like that. And then, so we have that. And then we have the puppet. And it's revealed that the puppet used to just be a homeless kid that he found and was kind of the doctor's first ever
reanimation experiment. Yeah. So he's basically reanimated a homeless child into a glove puppet, which is a very kind of, but again, it's like in the context of, it's kind of sort of quite bad taste, but it's also funny.
Yeah.
It's funny. I don't know, but again, it's sort of like, it's difficult to know how this comes across in the film where you go, it is, it's all funny. It's all done for laughs. What? It's all like fun. And yet when you're watching it, I guess that's it. It feels like when you watch a film, it's like you're watching it totally out of context. I don't, and it's interesting why the context of it changes so much in a film than it would in a comic book.
Well, I can't help but think that obviously, like, we're two step removed talking about it. So obviously people are going to listen to this conversation and we're just probably going to sound like a couple of madmen, like talking about this film. Like that is adapted from that comic, because it's like we genuinely just sound like we're just pulling stuff out, like, oh yeah, robot out of here. And it's like, if you haven't seen this film or you know nothing about graphic music or Mike Allred's work, this conversation is going to be absolutely baffling to people.
I think that's probably it. Like you say, I think it's better to go in. I think you'd get a lot more out of it if you know what the context is that it was kind of created. Because instead you get a movie that exists in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Where it's not really like any other film.
No.
And I guess it's closer comparison are things like Mystery Men. Mm-hmm. It's probably as close again, which is in itself based on, I guess, a similar source material that come from, in fact, it's very similar because that's based on Flaming Carrot comics, but they've exercised Flaming Carrot and used the supporting cast to make a film. So probably that's exactly, if you had a double bill with this film, you would have it with Mystery Men, I imagine.
Amazing. Well, yeah, so in that wrap up, we get the devil shows up, he gives them a second chance to live on Earth. They kind of go out and they ask the immortal question, like, how are we gonna get to heaven? And we get Cheetah Man just peering off a roof, and like it just has this weird, like, I'm not sure if it's like all of a sudden like this, it feels like a message movie in that moment. Like when Cheetah Man delivers that line, it's like, you've just got to do good deeds every day to get to heaven. And it's like, Oh, wait a second. Is this like a snuck in a bit of a religious movie in here to kind of be like, and ladies and gentlemen, that's the moral. Do a good deed every day. What did you kind of make of that ending?
Again, I think I didn't, in a way, I didn't wince or do anything because it's so much like, mm-hmm. it's sort of the thing that it is. It's like, it's silly.
Yeah.
It knows it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of corny. It's deliberately so. It's all those things. It just doesn't. Yeah, it is. It's such a, when I watched it, I was completely, I remember watching it and being a bit like, yeah, it's all right. The first time I saw it, which is probably 18 years ago. And yet watching it now, I just watched it thinking, oh, wow. Imagine if you knew nothing about what this is based on.
Yeah, me.
No, that's you. And I watched it and watched it from that perspective and went, this would be wild if you've got that. And you think, this is the audience, you know, it's invented, you know, it's a movie. It's for a wide audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But none of them, I'd like to think, like, hipper people might get it, perhaps. I don't know, like, if they kind of went in, like, but I guess what it would need as a movie is probably, like, if that was a big movie, it would have a marketing team behind it and they would be promoting this movie with all the actors kind of explaining what it was and where it came from. When it's a low-budget movie that kind of creeps out, you don't get any context for where it's come from or who made it or what it's based on. You just get the finished film in isolation. And I guess there's probably lots of big mainstream, big-budget sci-fi movies that don't really work unless they're sold to you by people telling you kind of what the plot is before you go and see it. You know, yeah. Go, all right, well, it's that, is it? I'll go and see it.
I think if I had watched this under different circumstances, because I had to kind of watch it with like an analytical eye to talk about it and kind of like really pay attention. Whereas if this was kind of like a Friday night and the world was open and we could like have a few beers and a few friends around or whatever, It's a great like bit of fun. It's a very much is, like you said, how it's almost sold now. It's like an oddity that comic book, and it has now made me like interested. If anything, yeah, it's made me interested to be like, oh, well, kind of want to check out like Michael Rood's work and the comic and stuff like that, and try and see if I can track down a copy of that DVD just to like, I don't know, see what he thinks about the film. Because again, like looking up online.
From what I recall, and certainly my first watching of it, of course you're over the moon because you've basically made, this is it. This is the whole, this is the whole thing. This is my comic on screen. You've done it, and it's not a thing where it turns up and you go, well, that character doesn't really look like that. And that, you've not really, that doesn't look who that's meant to look like. You're just watching it going, wow, you've done it really faithfully. You know, it's like kind of, that's exactly what it's supposed to be like.
So, in the best way that we could have, talking about this very confusing movie, I think we've given the listeners enough that if they are going to dip their toe into G-Men from Hell, they're going to, or if they want to avoid it, they very much will. But one of the features to do on this new journey is looking at any weird connections we could find between this film, whether it's an actor or somebody who worked on the film who turns up in another Coppola film. Did you manage to find any, Daniel?
Well, I think I've done what I was supposed to. I wasn't sure if I've done it the right way, but just a very obvious one is that William Forsythe's in Raising Arizona with Nick Cage.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you need, or do you want even more kind of tenuous 6 degrees ways of... I mean, if you go through degrees of degrees, I reckon everyone, I'm sure you could go.
Oh, no. That is perfect. Yeah, if we start going 6 degrees, we're going to be here, all week.
I reckon I could get the whole cast back to Coppola in six.
Well, I found on the last record, I went through every single 1 degree I could find. But I think it's going to be very boring for the listeners. So what I'll do from now on, guys, is we'll do a few back and forth, and then I will put it in the show notes or give you access to more connections I could find. But some of the more weirder ones and I could find is both Tate Donovan and Barry Newman appear in the OC, the TV series, which Jason Schwartzman's band Phantom Planet provided the theme song California for. So that's a real like tenuous link for this film.
I think I should point out that I guess at the time this film came out, Tate Donovan was kind of like a nearly man, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was always at the cusp of kind of, he's in like a lot of these guys, nearly people who were nearly somebody. Not that he's not anyone, but you know, like he was nearly a big star, you know.
Yeah.
It could have been. And again, there's no reason he wouldn't have been. He's perfectly good, and he's like a good actor in things. I like Tate Donovan a lot.
Yeah.
I think he could easily have been a big star.
William Forsythe as well is also in The Rock. So like only 3 years before this. Yeah, he was working with Nick Cage.
In a very similar comic book movie, actually. He's Flattop in Dick Tracy.
Yes, yeah. That is like kind of any time you... a lot of the reviews for G-Men from Hell, that's kind of where people like go, William Forsythe back in the kind of Dick Tracy world, almost that kind of, he's doing another like one of those films. Is there any other connections you could find, Nathaniel?
I bet there is. I'm surprised more don't jump out at me. But that was the first one that I saw. I was sort of worried I was going to get it wrong. I mean, Boosie must have been in. What's Boosie done there?
So Boosie is also in Lost Highway with Patricia Arquette from 1997.
Of course.
But he has never been in any film with a Coppola family member, which is absolute, unless I've missed it. If you're at home and you're...
I can't think of any. Like, yeah. I feel like I was about to say, when I looked down the cast list, like, Boosie was the one that went, right, well, Boosie is in. And when you run through your little Rolodex of movies, you go, can't think of one. That's right.
And then another link is Frank McRae plays Meat Foreman in Rocky 2. Which obviously stars Talia Shire, there's a lot more. Again, we'll leave it off with one very tenuous link, which is Robert Goulet's song "Pledging My Love" is in Mr. Wrong, which Jonathan Schwartzman is the DOP for, which is I think it's a film that's directed by Nick Castle. Like a night. It's starring Ellen and... I'm trying to think who the guy is in it. I'm not going to think for too long, guys. Again, this episode will end up being very, very long. And another weird bit of trivia. One of the quoted reviews on Wikipedia for this film is by Nathan Rabin for the AV Club, who also hosts a Nicolas Cage-centric podcast titled Travolta Cage. And his review, like the quote they give on Wikipedia, is G-Men's bare bones production values are forgivable, but its lack of wit and creativity isn't. So not a fan of this film, which leads me on to my scoring system for films in Coppola Connections, which is, what would be a perfect wine pairing for this film? AKA, is this a high tier wine or is this a kind of off license wine?
I would say it's an off-license wine, and it's entirely, like, it's not trying to be anything else. I think an off-license wine or a couple of bottles of off-license wine is almost the perfect, like, get a deal. If there's a deal, a twofer, go for it. And I think that's sort of the spirit it's meant to be enjoyed in as well. Yeah. I think it's not, I mean, for a lot of it, there's nothing pretentious about it. It's really trying to be a fun movie.
I would say, if anything, it goes more onto the white wine side, just in the fact that it's not heavy. Last week's film was The Conversation, very much a red wine film. Like, do you know what I mean? It's very like, oh, it's a lot to that. And obviously there's that famous scene with the blood in the toilet, which he brings over a bottle of wine to his girlfriend's house at the beginning of that film. So it's a red wine connection there. But obviously, yeah, this film. And how much are you paying for this bottle of wine? As you said, a twofer. How much is that twofer?
So I'm thinking it's probably going to be a tenner for two, right? You're thinking it's going to be like a kind of £2 for £10, I reckon.
Yeah, yeah, considering, like, I would say if you, like, you're not, if this were a restaurant wine, you're not turning over the page to that second page of the expensive stuff, are you? You're very
not
much...
if you were Nicolas Cage, maybe. He might well. He probably enjoyed that with a wine that went into the thousands when he sat at home and watched it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. He was a big wine connoisseur. Well, he is still. And I think in his wild days of spending money, he was spending ridiculous amounts of money on wine.
This made me wonder, for this podcast specifically, you wonder, has Nicolas Cage watched this film?
Yeah, I don't know.
Really?
I don't. I very rarely hear him talk about his. That's something very. And we'll get on to. Yeah, we'll get on to Nicolas Cage.
I reckon that. Nicolas Cage is probably he's probably target demographic, really. I think he'd probably quite like it.
So, Nathaniel, would you recommend people watch this film?
I think I am the worst person to judge it because I have the context of it. But I think I'm trying to be really objective about it. I think it's pretty good. I think it's a solid, I think it's quite a solid movie. And for what I want out of it, I'm like, it's fun, this, I like it. And I think it's really interesting. It's a much more interesting film to me than it is to a lot of people, I suspect.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I was going to ask you because I couldn't tell. I just felt so kind of close to it in a way. I found it a very difficult film to judge. And so but I kind of understood straight away from you that it was like, right, it is kind of impenetrable. I wondered that when I was watching it because it's kind of like I kind of know what it is and I know what it was based on. I have a full context for it. And to me, it's still pretty, I think the problem I have with it is that thing where it probably isn't. I think it's a really interesting experiment, but maybe adapting comic books very faithfully isn't a good idea for mm-hmm. movies. And yet, yeah. As an experiment, it works in exactly the same way something like Sin City does for me. And it's sort of still fun in the same way a film like that would be for me. But I don't know that it's a success at what it's doing. But I think it's a really interesting someone having a go and going, yeah, sure. Why not try that at least once, and a film that predates Sin City.
Well, as for recommendation from me, I would say, put this middle of your list. If you've got some classics to get through, I wouldn't bump them down. And obviously, you can watch this film for free on YouTube. Obviously, if you can rent it or buy it, do that. Obviously, we're not promoting piracy over here. But again, get a few friends together. I'm not sure how people are watching films these days. Whether they're, I know Zoom parties and that are pretty big. And if you're a fan of the source material, then Nathaniel, sure. I think it would definitely work for people, right? And it's
fair to say if it's on your list and you can watch this and you go, well, I've never seen Apocalypse Now and I've never seen G-Men from Hell, I'd probably watch Apocalypse Now. but yeah, if you've seen all those, yeah, I would say if you've heard this and any of it piques your interest and you have a context to what it's going to be like and it sounds like you might enjoy that, then you might well enjoy it. I think you might get a lot out of it.
Perfect. Well, so are the Coppolas or Coppolas? I keep getting that wrong. It is Coppola, isn't it? Are they the greatest film family of all time?
I think so. Because the others tend to be, I think they're the ones that have the most sort of spider's legs of films going into other films.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also, most of the other kind of big Hollywood dynasty people are actors and lots of them have made very good movies, but I kind of feel like probably like movie for movie and what you're getting with the Coppolas, they are. I mean, I think you've got to kind of hand it to them and say, they're the ones you wouldn't want to be without as a filmography.
Well, we're talking about being without leads me perfectly onto a question, which is, if you were to only keep one member of the Coppola family and you had to get rid of the filmography of every single other member, which one would you choose?
I think you'd have to keep Francis's. I mean, if anything, he probably produces half of Sofia Coppola's ones anyway. So I don't know if you get to keep them or not, but then you have all those films like, well, I guess you get American Graffiti if you have things like his filmography. And if you've got things he produced, you've got probably most of Sofia Coppola's films. You'll have Sleepy Hollow. You'll have, he produces a lot, and certainly throughout the 80s did an awful lot of producing as well. Paper Moon, I think, is produced by Coppola, I think.
Yeah.
So you get a lot of that. He has his hand in a lot of films of that era. When he was, he was Francis Ford Coppola, one of the biggest directors in the world. He really did have his hand in lots of pies.
I think one of the missteps he made in a person that he produced their films is Victor Salvo. Because I think he produced Powder and Jeepers Creepers.
Yeah, he did. He did.
And like, probably not the horse to back, but...
No, what a funny old thing. I wonder what he saw in him.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very bizarre avenue to take, especially...
Even Jeepers Creepers in the context of, like, horror movies is a kind of... It's like even in not a kind of, big kind of... prestige genre like that, it's not even a heavy hitter. It's a perfectly kind of, it's fine.
I think arguably without Francis Ford Coppola making films as well, we wouldn't even have Star Wars. Star Wars wouldn't exist, because if he hadn't have known George Lucas and kind of like, not bullied him or forced him, but like got him to make, like kind of prodding him to make like THX and stuff like that, he wouldn't have probably gone, oh no, actually I'm going to try this like popcorn thing. Like, do you know what I mean? I'm going to nick a, like, I still like the sci-fi element. Oh, Steven's doing something really interesting with Jaws. Let's see if I can better that. Yeah. But I think,
the Lucasfilm thing is like American Zoetrope done again. Or certainly more successful, whether it's done better. It probably had slightly lower ideals than American Zoetrope did, but it was a successful version of that in a way that American Zoetrope wasn't really ever, didn't manage to be what it was supposed to be.
And we'll close out the conversation by, I'm trying to figure out probably the greatest mystery in the Coppola family history, which is, what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
I always think he's probably saying, do you think this is a bit of a cop-out? It's one of those, I think it's a thing that has its cake and eat. It's just a bit like, it both works in a kind of, it's very kind of arch and a bit, you don't actually know. And then but it always has that thing like, do you know? Mm-hmm. Like, do you have a definitive answer to this, or is it just a bit of a, no one knows? You don't know. Is it romantic? Is it not? Would it work? Would it not? It's that kind of, it doesn't answer any of the things in the, and I think it's that kind of, as an ending, I guess it works for the kind of movie it is, because it's a bit well done. But at the same time, it is always a bit like, there's something quite unsatisfying about it as well.
Yeah,
I think it does have its cake and eat it a bit, which is a bit kind of, I think it's always been a bit of a cop out, and I can imagine them, the two actors, perhaps thinking, "Have we got an ending for this?" And that is the ending, and so it might well be them saying, "This is a cop out." And they've just caught this kind of little conversation of them, the two actors, and going, that'll do. We'll just have that. Cut the mics.
Bury the sound. That's a perfect answer, Nathaniel. Thank you very much for joining some dots and making some Coppola connections with me.
My pleasure. My pleasure, anytime.
Thank you once again to Nathaniel Metcalf for joining me on this journey. And that's two votes for the Coppola family being the greatest film family of all time. If you have happened to have seen this film and feel like me and Nathaniel missed anything or we got anything wrong, please don't hesitate to get in touch, which is on all the socials at Caged In Pod. So that's Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd and Facebook. Or you can always send me an email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. And on all future episodes, if you've seen any of the films that we're going to be covering, please do send a nice quick 20 to 30 second audio clip of your thoughts on that film. As for next week's episode, I will be joined by Jonathan Foster of the amazing Podchild Cinecast to talk about 1976's Rocky, starring Talia Shire. Next week's episode as well will be coming with some exciting news that I cannot wait to share with you guys. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to rate, review and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Acast or wherever you're listening to this right now. I've been Petros Patsilivas, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. So be sure to keep it Coppola and I'll catch you next time.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, parental controls, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Podcharles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.